What do noisy parrots and teenage daughters have to do with each other? Both are terrorising the suburbs of Perth, or at least that's what I'll prove to you today. Hi and welcome to Understory, Western Australia's only environmental radio program. I'm your host, Tom Wilson. Today we hear an excerpt from a speech given by Sue Murphy on the future of water in Perth, as well as from Peter Mawson on the takeover of our city by the invasive rainbow lorikeet. First off, I'm bringing you an excerpt from the 2010 George Seddon Memorial Lecture. This lecture is an annual affair which remembers the great landscape historian and author George Seddon. I attended the lecture last Wednesday evening at UWA. This year's topic was the future of water use in Perth, and who better to deliver this kind of lecture by than the CEO of the Water Corporation, Sue Murphy. In listening to the following excerpt, watch out for the point where Sue Murphy admits that she can't even regulate her own teenage daughter's shower use.
This is a look at the integrated water supply scheme as it was in 1993. Dams to the south, bore fields to the north. Dams, the dam water is stored in the hills, so gravity feeds down to Perth, and a whopping great pipeline, courtesy of C.Y. O'Connor, out to Kalgoorlie. From 1993 to 2007, the corporation had been very busy, so that's what you're paying for when you pay your water bills. And we've built lots and lots and lots of things. We've augmented our dams quite substantially. We've connected up all of our systems extensively. And we've built a very large seawater desalination plant on the coast. What this now means is a very flexible system that in years of heavy rain we can rely more on surface water catchments. We can run solely off groundwater if there's been a sudden rainfall event and there's a lot of sediment and silt in the dams. And we can run our desal plant as a base load year round, which makes it very energy efficient, and bank that water if we have surplus water there and use it in the drier months. Right now, our desal plant is complete. Our southern seawater desal plant is well underway and will come online at the end of 2011. But as we go forward, what are the solutions? And there are myriad solutions, and they depend on how Perth moves. We're looking at groundwater replenishment, and I'll talk about that a bit later, in the north of Perth. We're looking at a number of possible future desal sites to the far north of Perth. It requires, you'll see there's not major trunk mains to bring that water in. The trunk mains are all to the south and it requires extension there. But as Perth's growing to the north, that makes more sense. There are potentially savings or increases in catchment runoff to be made through catchment thinning, and we have a trial underway to look at that at the moment. There's coastal groundwater, which is non-economical when you have to pump it a long way to Perth, but if Perth continues its northern sprawl, that groundwater may become an attractive option. There's a whole lot of issues in the Collie area. There's a whole lot of solutions. So suffice to say, we're not short of an engineering solution, but they're capital-hungry and capital-intensive. So the obvious thing to get working on is to reduce water use. And if we are going to make the changes we want to see in our society, we're aiming to reduce per capita water use by 15% by 2030. Now, per capita water use in Perth has come down 20%, or just about 20%, in the last 10 years. So you could be forgiven for patting yourself on the back and thinking we're doing a great job, and why would we even bother looking ahead? But the facts are that our water use, compared to other cities in Australia and internationally, is still very, very high. We're third only to Oslo and Jerusalem. And believe me, the words Perth, Oslo and Jerusalem are very rarely said in one sentence. But what you can see on this is that Sydney and Melbourne are way less than us, partly because they've had a total outdoor sprinkler ban for most of the last few years, but also because their rainfall patterns are different, the sizes of their blocks are different, and they are not on a sand pit where every drop of water that goes on the ground disappears straight into your groundwater before you bat an eyelid. But it does tell us that there is a long way to go. And without a sackcloth and ashes lifestyle, we can achieve water savings. 19% of Perth's households have swimming pools, according to the study. If you have a swimming pool with a cover, that uses about 21 kilolitres per year. If you have a swimming pool without a cover, it uses 45 kilolitres per year. And about two-thirds of houses have uncovered swimming pools. So when you work the math, 19% of houses have pools, Two-thirds are not covered, one-third are. You come up with an average per house of 9.5 kilolitres. And that applies to all of these numbers. By 2030, we don't propose that you significantly change your kitchen and laundry use. In the last 10 years, laundry use has dropped by more than half compared to, not use of the laundry, I should say water use in the laundry. I'm assuming people still wash their clothes, although I'm not sure that we actually asked that question. But what we've found is that the penetration of more water-efficient washing machines has been phenomenal. It's difficult. You have to go out of your way to buy a water-inefficient washing machine these days. It's a real success story. And similarly, the use from taps in kitchens and people brushing their teeth is pretty much Australia's best practice. So we're not proposing any changes in that area. Keep up the good work. We're suggesting that the penetration of dual-flush toilets is about 75%, and we can move further on that and save a couple of kilolitres in toilets. It's a fabulous thing. Once you've got an efficiently flushing toilet, you're saving the water no matter what happens. We're not proposing some phenomenal change in your diet and that you're not going to use the toilet as much. The bathrooms are a fascinating area. Our water use study shows that water use in bathrooms and showers has gone up dramatically, nearly 20% in the last 10 years. It's symptomatic, apparently, of increasing affluence, is that we have increasing cleanliness. Now, I live in a house with three teenage daughters, and I have failed dismally in my attempts to get them to control their shower use. And in fact, the corporation gives out as a little freebie a little shower timer that you can put on the wall to time a three-minute shower. And one of my daughters suggested that that was very handy because it timed how long to leave the conditioner on your hair. So you can see that whilst I say this, my ability to influence in my own home is very small. But we believe that that modest change can be made through aerators, not through having a miserable, horrible shower, but through some of the aerators and better ways of running showers, and some common sense in the way we approach this. Hoses for your garden and hand watering have come down over the last few years, and we believe they'll continue. Block sizes are getting smaller, and modest changes there should be possible. We're looking at reasonable changes in reticulation. We have seen a big change in that through the last few years with our water efficiency measures in place. The survey we did was before the total winter sprinkler ban, which saves us of the order of 5 gigalitres per annum, and so may contribute to this in its own right. So we believe with that also block sizes are getting smaller and changes in landscaping can actually bring that change about. And we believe that if we can halve the leaks, which is not a particularly aspirational target, and have a greater penetration of swimming pool covers, which also save energy if people have heated pools and save chlorine and chemical use, so they're a cost saving to the householder. Without misery and sackcloth and ashes, we can quite easily and quite realistically see how that 15% per capita demand can be reduction can be achieved. It's not going to mean a whole new lifestyle, but it is going to mean looking at some of the ways we build our houses, and let's look at smaller gardens with less irrigated area and more use of paving and more use of water efficient plants. It's about looking at the social amenity we can provide from public open space by using recycled or fit for purpose water to water that. So with our population predicted to double in the next 50 years and our climate continuing to dry, our garden design and landscape architecture becomes even more important. Whether our sense of place is created by personal attachment or defined by geographical characteristics, the challenge for Perth, I believe, is to design a future of our own, a future resilient to changing climate. How we use and value water must be a catalyst for defining the very essence of our sense of place in this unique plane that we call home. Landscape redesign is vital to accommodate this growth and preserve or perhaps intensify our sense of place. Smaller backyards, shared quality public open space watered with fit-for-purpose treated wastewater, retention of remnant bushland, use of native low water demand plantings, these will all be part of it. But we have yet failed to crystallise the essence of what the Perth-built environment ought to be. To date, our aspirational form has always been someone else's utopia, be it Old England, Kew Gardens, or Beverly Hills. I think it's time for us to wake up and grow up and define our own sense of place.
And it's fitting that Sue Murphy was giving her talk under the aegis of the writer George Seddon. One of Seddon's great bit of advice is that he repeated again and again in his books to homeowners in Perth was fear the hose. Finally today we hear from Peter Mawson, Principal Zoologist at the Department of Environment and Conservation. Peter recently talked with me about the great invasion of our trees and skies by the colourful rainbow lorikeet and what the Department of Environment and Conservation has been doing in response to this invasion. People will have noticed that very colourful birds are basically taking over Perth at the moment, or have been for the last 3 or 4 years, rainbow lorikeets. Can you tell me what they are and how they're taking over Perth?
They've actually been in Perth since the late 1960s, where they were derived from aviary escapes and releases and subsequent breeding in the wild. And because there was a very good environment for them and no major predation issues, either from natural predators or from human-induced control, the population built up to between 15 and 20,000 before we started taking action.
When would this have been?
By about 2005, 2006, the population was at 15 to 20,000.
Right, because I have noticed myself that they've definitely increased in numbers. I can remember when I was a bit younger, around 2000, there were far fewer of them in the trees around my house.
That's right, but also as the suburbs that you live in age and mature, they often become more suitable for the birds. So people living in the newer suburbs in the outer parts of Perth, especially in the northeastern corridor, would probably have not seen many at all in the last 10 years, but as the trees that were planted at the beginnings of those estates reach maturity and start flowering and fruiting, they become attractive to the birds. And so you see an influx of birds coming into those areas either on a seasonal basis or once they reach peak maturity, the birds will not reside there on a permanent basis.
So they're eating the fruit of large trees and drinking the nectar from the flowers, is that it?
Yeah, the pollen and nectar feeders primarily, but they also feed on fruits from ficus, any of the things like Moreton Bay figs and some of the other planted fig species. But they'll also take advantage of bottle brushes, the callistemons when they're in full flower, and grapevines for either table grape or wine grapes in the Swan Valley, now that the population's reached to that extent. And they will also feed on figs, locusts, and they've, in the last 2 or 3 years, made forays into the Perth Hills in the fruit-growing areas to attack stone fruit crops.
So they've got quite a Catholic diet. I guess that's one of the things that gives them a competitive advantage against other birds.
They have, but they're very much tied to those food sources that have a fairly short duration. Flowers don't stay open for very long, so the nectar supply is quite short. And also fruits like figs and stone fruit and grapes often have a very short period when they're available. So the birds have to move around a lot and have a very good map in their head of where to go at certain times of the year to get their food supply.
And they move around in large social groups, large flocks?
They certainly do. They're a communal roosting bird, so at night you can get up to 5,000 or 6,000 birds in some of the major roosts. And during the day, prior to control being applied, it wasn't uncommon to see flocks of 100 to 200 birds moving around the landscape.
I can tell you, when sitting beneath the Norfolk pine down at Cottesloe Beach one evening in summer, you're basically deafened by their screeching above you.
It's quite amazing. I mean, you can't even hear trucks or buses pass down the road. They're just drowned out. The same at the Perth Airport. The movement of aircraft is pretty much drowned out by the noise of the birds at the using the trees outside the domestic terminal.
Now, when it gets to that kind of stage, you know there's a bit of a problem. What is the problem of having so many rainbow lorikeets in Perth?
Two problems. One, they're competing with our native honey eaters and wattle birds and the likes for the nectar and the pollen sources. And the second is that because they're a parrot, they're an obligate hollow nester, and so they're taking over tree hollows that would normally be used by our native small parrot species and even some of our bats. We've got some evidence to suggest that they're actually evicting the native bat species from those sorts of hollows.
Yeah, I've got a tree just around the corner from my house in Fremantle where I've noticed they've moved in frequently. The council have tried to get them out and they move straight back in. So this would be one of the principal problems, that they're stealing the nesting spots for things like little honey eaters. So is this going to see the downfall of some of our, say, New Holland honey eaters in the Perth metro area?
They were certainly having an impact on how readily those native birds could access the food. And they're quite an aggressive bird, the lorikeets, and so they'll actually chase other birds away from the food source. The other problem is the population has an endemic infection of a disease called Citicine beacon feather disease. It's a viral disease, common in a range of parrot species around the world, but not widespread in most of the native species in Western Australia. But in some years, you know, maybe as many as 10 or 20% of the young will come out of the nest presenting symptoms of beak and feather. In its worst form, the birds don't have properly formed wing and tail feathers, and they can't fly. So they just fall to the ground, run around until they get eaten by, you know, predators or run over by cars.
Sounds horrible.
But it is a transmissible disease to other species.
Right, so that's another danger, having them around here.
That's right.
And can you just briefly give me, I don't know if this is too much to ask, but the rise and fall of different invasive species of birds in Perth? I mean, would this have been the biggest influx of an invasive bird in Perth ever?
Certainly the one that's been allowed to go the longest before something was done about it. And part of that was making a decision of whether it was going to be an invasive species, whether it was going to be one that was going to cause any problems, and then making the political decisions. But there's a very long history of exotic species of birds being introduced into Perth. There were even things back in the late 1890s through to 1910, 1912, a lovely group of gentlemen called the Acclimatisation Society of Western Australia, whose job it was to identify species they thought should be introduced into Perth or Western Australia and to arrange for them to be brought in, bred up in numbers and actually released. That's how the kookaburra came to southwest WA. It's not native to WA, but it was actually brought in, bred up in captivity in the Perth Zoo, and released to a number of sites into the southwest, where it's become very successfully established.
It's interesting you should mention the kookaburra. I was talking to a beekeeper, an apiarist down on the Darling Scarp, not too far from Pinjarra recently. He was telling me when he moved into his property in the early 1970s, he counted 66 species of birds. Today he'd see roughly half of that number. And he attributes the decline to the rise of the kookaburra, and because they can actually eat small birds.
During the springtime, they certainly do feed on nestlings, but there's likely to be a number of other factors that are contributing to the decline of those species.
So a little bit unknown, I suppose.
Some of them are well known for some of the species on the Swan Coastal Plain, just the fragmentation of the natural environment into smaller and smaller chunks with larger distances between them mean that species like wrens and scrub wrens, some of the thornbills, can't move from one remnant to another. It's just too far to go across alienated landscape or just the distance itself. And so eventually those species drop out, especially after you get fire in those remnants.
I suppose my friend there, he's actually on the edge of a national park or a large area of state forest, so habitat fragmentation might not be the major cause, but there would be other causes as well, wouldn't there?
For some species, it's just our changing climate. We've had a 25 to 35% reduction in our average annual rainfall since the 1970s, and that's not due directly to what people in Perth are doing. That may be a function of climate change, whether it's global warming or not. But the result is our winters are shorter, they're not as wet, they often start later in the year. And if you're a species that's dependent on, you know, damp conditions and the resultant vegetation growth from that, then you may well be doing it hard.
Right. Well, let's get back to Perth for a second. So what is the Department of Environment and Conservation doing, and have they been doing about the upsurge in rainbow lorikeet numbers?
A working group was established in conjunction with the Department of Agriculture and Food, WA, and the Fruit Growers Association, and the Table and Wine Grape Growers Association, and some other community members, to first of all assess the pest status of rainbow lorikeets, and that was proven quite conclusively, and to develop a management strategy. We said what we would do and where we would apply it. And the result of that was that the Department of Agriculture eradicates any outbreaks of rainbow lorikeets in country areas. And the Department of Environment and Conservation has undertaken a control program since 2007 in the metropolitan area to reduce the numbers. And the idea was not to eradicate them, that was considered unfeasible given the resources that were likely to be available, but to reduce the population to at least below 50% of what it was estimated at in 2006.
So it was estimated to be 10 or 15,000?
Between 15 and 20,000. So we're looking to get it back to 7 to 10,000.
Have you succeeded?
We've been more successful than we had anticipated. Since 2007, we've taken more than 23,000 birds out of the population.
Right, okay.
Which says, well, you must have got rid of them all. But during the years 2007 to now, they've continued to breed, and we're taking out a proportion of the existing population plus their reproductive output for each year.
So you're telling me that people in Perth should have noticed fewer rainbow lorikeets in their gardens in the last 3 years?
Lots of people I talk to, when they actually stop and think about it, they made the comment that they're seeing a lot fewer. The size of the flocks that they see flying by are smaller. Instead of being 20 to 50 or 100 birds, they're down to, you know, tens and unusual flock size these days in a lot of areas, and people are only seeing them ones and twos. The major bird call they hear in the dawn chorus when they're, you know, just starting to wake up in their beds in the morning isn't rainbow lorikeets anymore. And
that's
that was
good
certainly
news.
The case.
Yeah, that's great news for our local birds then. Okay, well, thanks very much, Peter Mawson, Principal Zoologist at the Department of Environment and Conservation.
It's a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Understory, RTR-FM's weekly environmental radio show. See you same time next week, and don't forget to sign up for the podcast of the show on RTR's website. That's www.rtrfm.com.au.